Dr. Lagakos, in your book you describe several situations in which a calorie is not a calorie. I found the discussion of HGH particularly fascinating, yet you do not recommend it as a fat loss supplement. Why not?
In the book I did describe a scenario where a group of patients were taking human growth hormone in a clinical study, and regardless of the amount of calories they ate, it seemed to favorably impact, you know, nutrient partitioning. More of those calories went into building muscle and less went into storing fat. So it seemed to produce a very favorable overall outcome.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think, it, you know, I used that example just to demonstrate, you know, that nutrient partitioning is a very important phenomenon that can be mediated by hormones. The hormone in this case was human growth hormone. When it comes down to human growth hormone in athletes, I'm not really, I mean, it has a lot of use in, you know, treating certain conditions, but I'm not sure how good it would be for people that are already healthy and already engaging in regular exercise. High intensity exercise is like a known stimulus for your natural growth hormone.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know about adding on top of that how much it would do. And also, there hasn't been a whole lot of clinical studies on growth hormone in sort of elite athletes or athletes of really very many calibers. So I would prefer to say if that's an avenue you want to explore, just stick with the high intensity resistance exercise to boost your own natural growth hormone levels, at least until some more research is done on this particular patient population.
Gotcha. So one of the things I've noticed is that all the studies are either on the average citizen or on those who are severely deranged, but not on geared towards performance. So
right.
I feel that so much of what we know might not apply directly to athletes.
Right, and so we have to make inferences and see what's out there and also do some personal experimentation.
Mm-hmm. So, continuing on the lines of ergogenic aids, have you ever come across the whole nicotine thing?
Yes. Yeah, I have. And nicotine, if it wasn't for that pesky little addictive property of nicotine, it would probably be a vitamin. I mean, it does have a lot of net beneficial effects on cognition. It's a very potent anti-inflammatory agent, and it's even been shown to improve insulin sensitivity. When it comes down to its use in for promoting health, I think its strongest aspect would be in sort of helping to attenuate appetite in like an obese patient who's trying to lose weight, or especially in someone who is overweight and is quitting cigarettes to help with prevent the sensation-induced weight gain. Again, I'm not sure how well this would work in an athlete. It might have some effects in promoting cognition or improving your focus.
Mm-hmm.
Or after, this is purely speculative, but after a, you know, a intense exercise session, you know, the next day or 2 days later when you're extremely sore, it might, some of the anti-inflammatory effects of nicotine might be helpful in those scenarios.
Interesting. And I didn't look too much into it, but I know that tobacco products are known to decrease insulin sensitivity. Make you,
yes,
insulin resistant, but the nicotine by itself is the opposite, right?
Yes, that's definitely true, and there are actually a couple studies that I've discussed on my blog that show that there are bad things in cigarettes that are not due to the nicotine. Nicotine probably plays a role in the addictive component, but not the other negative health effects.
Gotcha. So before we go too far into the rabbit hole of insulin sensitivity, did you have any thoughts on the whole, if you're already eating a ketogenic diet, is there any point in trying to further control blood glucose levels, especially in those of us who don't have problems with blood glucose, either average or postprandial?
No. Insulin sensitizing agents are useless for ketogenic dieters. I don't know how to say it otherwise. If you're not being exposed to the dietary carbohydrates, then you really have little need for high level of insulin sensitivity. And in fact, I would go further to say that if you are adapted to the ketogenic diet or low carbohydrate diets, your insulin sensitivity might even decline a little bit. And the, you know, the point is that doesn't matter because you don't need to have insulin spikes because you're not eating the carbohydrates.
Okay, gotcha. So that kind of moots the point or the questions about the bitter melon and the berberine and cinnamon and things like that.
Right. Well, they might have other effects inside the body, like on inflammation or on oxidative stress. They could have some benefits there, but when it comes down to their ability to help manage blood glucose levels, that's not going to matter too much for low-carbohydrate or ketogenic dieters.
And out of curiosity, do you happen to know the mechanism, how it works, how it does that?
There are a couple different ones. Some of them actually work on the amylase enzymes in your digestive tract, so you don't digest the carbohydrates as well. Other agents act at the insulin receptor and enhance insulin sensitivity so that you can dispose of the carbohydrates at a more rapid rate after they've been ingested. There's really a wide spectrum of these things.
Okay. And I know in your book you push protein a lot, and a big concern among us is eating too much protein and gluconeogenesis and that possibly kicking us out of ketosis. And do you think that there's a use for these blood sugar controls in to prevent that, or once again, not an issue?
I think that's two different issues. When you're eating too much protein on the ketogenic diet, it's not going to, actually on any diet, it's not going to cause hyperglycemia or it's not going to raise blood glucose levels. It will kick you out of ketosis. I think that's primarily because maintaining the ketotic state depends on a high rate of fatty acid oxidation in the liver. And when you do eat protein, you know, above your minimal requirements, above what can be used for protein synthesis, then amino acid oxidation will occur in the liver, and that will occur in preference to fatty acid oxidation. So then you're not going to be getting ketones from that route. And also excess dietary protein can be stored as glycogen in the liver. So if your liver is filled up with, you know, glycogen, it's also going to have a low need to be oxidizing fatty acids. But at really under no condition that I've ever seen, even under enormous intakes of protein, will it cause elevations in blood glucose.
Ah, interesting. So here's a little bit of a curveball question. It wasn't in the notes I sent you, but I've read discussion by other doctors in that if you don't have more than, say, 15 or 20 grams of protein in a single sitting, that it just gets the amino acids just get used in your gut lining instead of going into the greater bloodstream. Know anything about that? Or
yes, yeah, I do. I don't think that's true. I think if you have a lower intake of protein, your body's probably going to try to capitalize on it more efficiently with increasing protein synthesis. When it comes down to the intestinal use, the intestine does use certain amino acids. For example, pretty much all of the glutamine in the protein that you eat is probably going to be metabolized in the intestine, whereas none of the branch chain, or very little of the branch chain amino acids, will be metabolized in the intestine. Actually, they won't even be metabolized in the liver. They completely bypass the liver under most circumstances and go straight to skeletal muscle, whereas a lot of the other amino acids will pass through the intestine and go into the liver for protein synthesis. So I'm not really sure where that statement or what was the context of that statement, but on just its face value, I don't think that, you know, if you don't exceed some threshold of protein intake, then you're going to, you know, experience no metabolic benefits of the protein.
So the context I heard it in was that if you're going to eat X amount of protein in a day, that you'd want to divide it up into just your three meals, for example, instead of small amounts throughout the entire day, for reasons of absorption, but you've just sort of debunked that, or in your opinion, you've debunked it. Which,
yeah, I don't think that would be true. I mean, there might be something if you take it to the other opposite extreme. Like if you have all of your protein in one sitting, then you might stimulate excess amino acid oxidation so that you wouldn't be getting, you know, it might be better to have, these numbers are completely theoretical, but it might be better to have two 50 gram meals of protein as opposed to one 100 gram meal of protein.
Right, yeah.
And then down to the other end, you know, do you want 10 gram meals? I don't think that would be too much of relevance.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, what about moving on into the aging and with large amounts of protein, mitochondria, questions dealing with those?
Okay, there is a body of literature about too much protein and aging, and it has to do with, you know, protein stimulating cell turnover, cell growth, and all of these things are promoting a negative environment for aging. It's rodent studies. I don't know if any human populations that have had a historically high level of protein intake and how that would affect their mortality rates. I think when it comes down to protein quality in the diet, I'm not so sure about how much a high protein intake is really going to impact longevity. It could. I mean, there's the mTOR hypothesis that it's going to increase aging. But I'm not, you know, once it comes down to the quantitative levels, are we talking about, you know, somebody who takes 75 grams of protein a day versus 200 grams of protein a day? Or is it, you know, more in the physiologically relevant areas of, you know, 75 grams versus 100 grams a day? That's a black box, and there are virtually no human studies that I know of looking at that.
Gotcha. So, you know, you posed this hypothesis of, you know, our lifespans might be by total calories consumed. Is that correct?
I don't know. I mean, that's exactly that. It's the hypothesis. I forget what the number was. Maybe it was a million calories in your life.
Mm-hmm.
It's how much you eat and you expend. And if you eat more than that, then it winds down your clock.
So if you decide to consume, say, the majority of your protein from amino acids directly instead of eating whole foods protein, you know, that's non-caloric. So,
no, it is caloric.
It is.
Yeah, amino acids do have roughly the same amount of calories as protein. But that brings up another sort of humorous point from back in my nutrition school days when, you know, we could always throw the curveball and say, well, actually, there's a zero dietary requirement for protein. You can get by and live perfectly healthy on no protein at all. And the catch was, well, then you still have to be getting a certain amount of all of the essential amino acids.
Hmm. So even the branch chains that are shuttled directly into skeletal muscle tissue, those are have a caloric count, so to speak?
Yep. They have calories and they do give you energy. And if you're exercising, your muscle will burn those branch chains for energy.
Interesting. Okay. And what about cold thermogenesis? And the take of it revving up your metabolic engine?
Mm-hmm. You know, that's another one of those black box areas. There's been a movement in certain aspects of the paleo culture for people that are, you know, taking cold showers or dunking their head in cold water and that helping. I'm not an expert on that at all. I mean, if you want to increase your brown adipose tissue activity, you can certainly do it that way. And there's been studies pro and con in athletes saying, you know, sometimes it'll come out and say it will impact certain aspects of athletic performance. I think one of the reasons why the human data in athletes is not all in line is because, one, they're always using very different protocols for the cold exposure.
Mm-hmm.
Two, they're usually measuring different outputs. Like if you take an athlete who's just gone under an extremely strenuous workout and dunk them in cold water, I don't think you're going to have the same physiological impact as if you wait until 2 days later when delayed onset muscle soreness kicks in and then you give them the cold exposure. And all the studies are not sort of getting their technique in line, so that's why there's discrepancies. I'm not going to discount the benefits of cold exposure, because it certainly could be helpful for many, but I'm not ready to give it a blanket endorsement for all athletes to start, you know, taking a cold bath daily.
But I guess I was sort of asking down at a mitochondrial level, am I correct in saying that when you do this cold training that you're increasing your mitochondrial density? Is that...
You could very well be improving your mitochondria. I mean, the response of the mitochondria to the cold exposure is going to be increased uncoupling, which could cause some oxidative stress down the line. But let me take this back to the ketogenic diet.
Mm-hmm.
Because the ketogenic diet is going to have a very beneficial impact on mitochondria number, function, quality. I mean, once you hit that 3-week mark where you've been in it for 3 weeks to a month of a state of ketosis, you're really going to have increased mitochondria number, and that's when, you know, you're no longer going to be tired. You're going to be able to maintain higher intensity workouts, increased endurance, and I think that's the primary mediator of that is the effect of the diet on the mitochondria.
Okay.
I think that's like actually, I mean, I from the athletic perspective, the keto adapted state is, in my opinion, it's critically dependent on the mitochondrial response to the ketogenic diet.
Okay. Now, I guess I should start moving into questions that are being asked a lot on our Run Keto forums and discussion group. And one that's come up is, about after this keto adaptation, it seems that the actual blood beta hydroxybutyrate values might not matter as much in terms of how you feel and perform. Is that because you're now running directly off free fatty acids instead of ketone bodies, or what's going on there?
You should still be using ketones for some things. For example, your brain, for example, it won't do very well on the fatty acids. It's going to be oxidizing ketones. I think there's a big inter-individual variability in the level of ketones that you get, and it's also going to matter time of day, when did you have your last meal. Once you are keto-adapted, you should register positive on a blood ketone meter. The urine keto sticks are a little bit iffy. Sometimes you're positive, sometimes you're not, and that's just because they're a little bit less sensitive. But I'm pretty sure that you should probably register above 1 millimolar if you've been keto adapted with the beta hydroxybutyrate. But your question about performance is sort of different. I would say to know if you're sort of successfully adapted to the ketogenic diet, I would say gauge it by performance. Gauge it by how do you feel. I mean, if you're not keto adapted, you will not have the same exercise tolerance as you did, you know, prior to going on this diet. And it should be very abundant. I mean, the first week of reducing your carbohydrate intake to less than 30 or 40 grams, your athletic performance is going to be reduced. And that performance will start to recover. That will be a more accurate reflection of keto adaptation.
Okay. So, do you know of any other quantitative measurements that any of our readers could take to do?
Actually, I think the blood meters is actually a pretty good one. There's not really too many that are better than that. I would say the urinary keto sticks is a distant second.
Okay. And what about this idea of deep ketosis? Is that, you know, someone, say their workout is no good and they're over 1 millimolar, but, you know, do they just need more time, or what's going on there?
Yeah, actually, the number one factor in the level of ketosis and how easy it is to get in and out of ketosis, I would say, is patient history, quote-unquote, would be the duration of time that you've been on the diet. Somebody who's been on the diet for months and months, maybe up to years, their ability to enter a deep state of ketosis should be relatively easily. And I mean, if they happen to go high on the protein and get knocked out of ketosis, I think they'll be able to recover into a deeper state quicker, and that will reflect the duration of time that they've been on the diet, which again, I'm speculating this a little bit, which again, I think is going to be reflecting their mitochondrial function, quality, and mitochondrial number.
All right. This is all great information.
Thanks, man.
So let's see. Kind of jumping around and going to calorie math. Did you have any thoughts on my little personal story of putting on 15 pounds in the last month?
Yeah, you wrote one line in there that I had me scratching my head. You thought it was unlikely that anywhere more than 4 pounds of it were muscle. And I don't think that that's true. I think more of that is going to be from muscle. I also think that if you're still maintaining the very low carbohydrate intake, then not very much of it is going to be water weight. Usually if you increase your carbohydrate intake, a lot of the weight you gain will be water weight. But if you're still maintaining the very low carbs, then I think it'll be less water. I would say probably 2/3 or more of the weight you gained would have been muscle. I mean, especially since, I guess all of your audience members know this, but people that are coming to this from my end might not, but you're an athlete who's exercising, eating a healthy diet. I think all of those things bode very well for the nutrient partitioning effect. So out of those 15 pounds, I would say probably, 12 might be muscle, 10 to 12 might be muscle.
Okay. Well, that's reassuring to hear.
Sure.
And what about salts? I know that in the transition period, your body is flushing out a lot of those water stores water that was stored with the carbohydrates, and thus a lot of salts are lost. But what about salt requirements post adaptation?
Yeah, well, I guess I'm going to be a little bit off topic here, but when you switch to this low carbohydrate ketogenic diet, it usually involves abandoning a lot of industrial processed foods that are usually very heavy on salt. Mm-hmm. So from one aspect, you're probably going to be getting a lot less salt in your diet. And I view that as sort of a healthy thing, because you're cutting out the processed foods. But you will probably need to start adding some salt to your food, because without the carbohydrates there, you're not going to have a lot of insulin. And insulin usually helps to promote the retention of the sodium and the retention of the salts. So low insulin means you tend to waste your body salts a little bit. And if you go to the extreme, the ketogenic diet, it's going to be magnified.
Okay. Interesting. I really liked in your book how you said that the insulin is more fat-promoting than muscle-building.
I do believe that. And there's been some very interesting, very elegant, I think, human studies that have shown that even if you infuse a very small amount of insulin, the adipose tissue just completely stops releasing fatty acids. It completely, shuts down. It goes into storage mode. And this is at a level of insulin that is well beneath that is necessary to stimulate glucose uptake into muscles, and is well beneath that is necessary to stimulate mineral retention, the salt retention in your body. So insulin, what it does best is store fat.
Okay. And what about readers' concerns about gut biome or thyroid function? I know those aren't exactly your area of expertise, but...
I do a lot of the gut function stuff.
Oh.
And that wasn't in the book. But that's also, a wild card for the ketogenic diet, because a lot of the gut bugs, the microbiome sort of flourishes on indigestible carbohydrates and some regular carbohydrates that just end up making it all the way down to the large intestine. And these foodstuffs are pretty much absent on the low carbohydrate or ketogenic diet. And that in and of itself doesn't bode very well for gut health. But there is a very good, patch for that, and it's fermented foods. I think fermented foods like sauerkraut, pickles, Some people like to ferment their milk into kefir. Mm-hmm. Those things are not high carbohydrate foods, and they're very, very healthy for gut function for everyone. Even, you know, people on standard American diets, they should be consuming more fermented foods. Mm-hmm. And the small amount of carbohydrates that are contained in these foods are generally going to be, you know, metabolized by the microflora that, you know, come with the food. And I think anyone on a low-carbohydrate diet who's experiencing any sort of gut problems, bloating, constipation, they should seriously consider fermented foods. I mean, you can make them yourself. It's really easy to, you know, I'm really good at letting foods get rotten. You know, you just chop up some foods, stick them in a jar, let them rot for a week. I mean, it ends up tasting quite delicious, but it's easy to make, and it's also very healthy for the gut.
Oh, yeah, I love fermenting. I've got kimchi going right now, and I do red wine vinegar. I even did some salmon ferments, actually.
It's a Swedish dish?
Inuit type of thing.
Okay.
Yeah, but I didn't bury it in the ground. I used the refrigerator.
Okay, good. Yeah, I've done a lot of kraut. I recently started doing some pickles. I'm a long time kefir fermenter. Awesome. Yeah, I think that the gut health on the low carbohydrate diet is a legitimate concern for some people. I mean, some people, you know, they have a gut of steel. And no diet is going to change that. But if anyone is experiencing any functional symptoms, I would say consider fermented foods. That's the way to go.
Okay. So just yesterday, I decided I'd start up with this resistant starch protocol, kind of promoted on the Feed the Animal blog. You take a tablespoon of potato starch, and the idea, and then if you take it with the fermented foods, you have a prebiotic going with the probiotic. Yeah. Getting
like
it all the way.
Taking it with the fermented foods, so you take the carb source and the bugs.
Right. So, not only that, but it's you know, I've got this fear of getting kicked out of ketosis, even though I really shouldn't. I mean, I know I've been in it for so long now that, but so I stir up the potato starch with a tablespoon of MCT oil.
Okay. That's the ketones, I see.
That's right.
Biohacker.
But, you know, my thought was once again going back to it's supposed to improve blood sugar control, but now I'm thinking maybe I don't have gut health issues, so maybe I don't need it for any reason.
Sure. I don't think there's going to be any deficiency in resistant starch. I think if somebody wants to supplement it, it should be someone who has a concern. You mentioned something about thyroid earlier.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think, and this is going to be just from very few studies and a little bit of speculation, I don't think that the carbohydrates are necessary for thyroid health. I think that if somebody's experiencing symptoms of hypothyroid on the low-carbohydrate or ketogenic diet, that's going to be more due to energy deficit. I mean, the diets are notorious for causing a spontaneous reduction in appetite. You put an obese patient on the ketogenic diet, you know, they'll spontaneously cut 500 calories from their food, you know, leading to massive fat loss. I think this energy deficit is going to be more inducive of hypothyroid-like symptoms than the ketogenic diet. Like someone who's getting adequate calories and good quality fat in their diet, and their weight maintaining, and they're not sort of trying to do this massive weight loss protocol, I don't think that they should be experiencing very many symptoms of hypothyroid.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more to do with, you know, adequate energy status.
So, just a interesting little anecdote. About this time last year, I convinced my mother to try a ketogenic diet for a month, and towards the end, she was getting these terrible hot flashes, and she was, you know, she has trouble keeping her weight up. And the part I haven't told you is basically since she was 20 years old, she had been taking synthetic thyroid because her own thyroid function had completely ceased.
Okay.
So 100% dependent on synthetic thyroid. And you know, she has these regular checkups to make sure everything's in line and blood work. And she goes in towards the end of this 30 days, and they say, whoa, you're way over-medicated.
Really?
And what had happened was in that 30 days, her own thyroid came back to life.
That's amazing. I love that story.
Yeah, so.
That's incredible.
I have been, yeah. Just the healing properties of ketone bodies seem to be phenomenal. And I'm really excited about all these ketone esters and ketone salts that are showing up.
Yeah, I actually just did a blog. I'm very frequently, I blog a lot. I just did a blog post this week, and it was about a potential role of those in mental health disorders and even in certain epileptic patients. It seems like some of those ketone salts can really boost the ketosis significantly, much more so than the coconut oil and the medium-chain triglycerides, which could have benefits for, you know, a huge population of people. You know, of course, ranging from, I mean, the product I was talking about was developed for athletes, but, you know, it shouldn't be restricted to athletes by any means.
Mm-hmm.
There was maybe 30 years ago, a guy published a paper out of a researcher in England named Richard Veach, and he did this very, very complicated study about, you know, infusing cardiac cells with different combinations of nutrients. And he found when he infused the ketones, there was like a 25% increase in power output with no increase in oxygen consumption. And he ended up, you know, giving them the term of a super fuel for that reason. And I really like that term. I think it's applicable.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. And then I've heard that down in Florida, they're doing some research with the Navy and the Air Force in being able to operate in a hypoxic state by fueling with ketones.
I didn't hear that, but that would make perfect sense. You know, you can maintain or even have an increased power output, performance capacity with lower levels of oxygen. That's actually really interesting. I didn't know that. Well, let me make a comment. I mean, this is, I think, more geared towards athletes. I think if you want to do this and experiment with the ketogenic diet, you need to sort of make a pact with yourself that you're going to go longer than, you know, 3 weeks to a month. Because I'm positive. I've seen this in athletes. I've seen this in non-athletes. You know, the first week on a ketogenic diet is going to be difficult. Your athletic performance is probably going to take a hit. And actually, that actually comes through in some of the clinical studies. I hate opening up, you know, a journal and reading an article that has this great first couple sentences about all the athletic performances that they're going to measure on the ketogenic diet, and then I find out that it's, you know, 5 days of carbohydrate restriction.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you right there that those athletes are going to suck. You know, they're going to be tired and their performance is going to be hindered. However, when you find the studies that go 3 weeks to a month, you know, pretty much every single performance capacity is recovered. So I think if you want to do it, you've got to stick with it for at least a month, and then your results, then you can start to reap some of the benefits.
Okay. And I just thought of another question I think I'd be remiss not to ask. What about refeed, either from a caloric deficit point of view or a carb refeed, which actually I personally believe is completely unnecessary?
I'm on board with that. I think that there's different theories about why someone might need a refeed, whether it's for emotional or psychological support. That's one thing that's, you know, completely different. I don't think there's any sort of biological need for an athlete or anyone else to go on to these refeeds. I don't think it'll have any net effect on performance, you know, in the long term. I mean, if you have a food that you're dying to eat and you're stressed out and you're depressed because you haven't eaten it, then you might benefit emotionally, but not when it comes to performance.
Okay.
Well, and your other question about the calorie refeed, that might be warranted. I mean, if you're in an energy deficit for too long, you know, I mean, maybe it's favorable because you're trying to lose the body fat, but, you know, you might not want to be in such an extreme energy deficit for too long. You might want to make sure you're getting adequate calories.
Right. Yeah. So, I haven't publicly posted about this, but I have talked with it. About it with other keto athletes who live near me, and basically I had for a while some libido issues, and I found that just by having one day out of every 14 where I stuffed myself with protein and fat, you know, that all was fixed.
Sure. I believe you're going to have a lot of hormonal changes that are going to have to do with sort of the energy deficit, and, you know, that's a fix.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we've had female readers comment about delayed cycles and things like that. And, of course, I don't feel like I'm in a position to counsel them about it. But
no, you're correct. The women on this diet might experience certain amenorrhea. They might not cycle at all if they're in an energy deficit for too long. That's a sort of a normal response to prolonged energy deficit.
And, you know, one thought I had, and this is pure speculation, is if a woman has amenorrhea.
Listen, I was talking all awkwardly about it.
Yeah, so basically her body is waiting until a better time for the potential to procreate. And in that way, is she potentially extending her lifespan farther? Because the body wants to live until it has a chance to reproduce?
I have no idea.
Oh.
That's beyond me.
Okay.
Interesting theory, though. But back to the male aspect of it, your libido issues. I also posted another blog recently about there were a few good intervention studies where they were comparing the low-carbohydrate to the high-fat diet. And in every intervention that I discussed, something prominent stuck out. Every high-fat diet was also very rich in saturated fats. And in most of these cases, they saw an increase in the free testosterone levels or bioavailable testosterone levels. Thought that was very interesting that, you know, all of the authors seem to attribute it not only to the fat content of the diet, but that it was rich in saturated fat as well.
Right. Yeah, that's actually one test I've never gotten. I have a lot of data on myself, but not testosterone levels, which I'd be interested in seeing at some time.
Well, hey, I would say you can just go by and gauge your libido.
Yeah.
There you go.
I know Dr. Davitt, your good friend, is really interested in all the cholesterol aspects and blood lipids. Do you follow that at all with the low carbohydrate?
I do, and I think anyone with any sort of high blood triglycerides. Blood triglycerides are as almost like a marker for dietary carbohydrate intake.
Mm-hmm.
When you have a high carbohydrates, triglycerides tend to increase. When you replace the carbohydrates with dietary fat, triglycerides go down. And if you're somebody who's at high risk factors, if you have a family history of heart disease or stroke or cardiovascular disease, and you have high triglycerides, I would say that carbohydrate restriction is something you should strongly consider to get that under control.
Mm-hmm. But have you seen or heard much about others who are hyper-responders to the saturated fat intake?
Usually when it comes to saturated, I actually heard a blog on this a few years ago. Saturated fat will increase total cholesterol, but it's pretty much one of the very few ways that we know that can increase HDL cholesterol, the good cholesterol.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, HDL cholesterol pretty much doesn't budge in anyone, no matter what you do. The one thing that you can get a few extra points on the HDL is increase the saturated fat. And I do know that there was some work done looking at particle size, and the low carbohydrate diet tended to favor sort of the larger LDL particles, which seem to have a lower atherogenetic risk profile, but so the net benefits seem to be favorable. You get the lowering of the triglycerides, the increase the HDL, and the LDL particle size shifted to a sort of a metabolically more healthy one. Okay, I'm not a huge fan of cholesterol lowering drugs, but I do prefer Zetia over any of the statin drugs.
Right, especially because it only works on the single enzyme dealing with absorption rather than on this giant tree of cholesterol throughout transport through the whole body.
Right. I mean, the cholesterol synthetic pathway controls a lot of things. I mean, you don't want to cut that off at the top like the statin drugs do. The LDL. I think the high HDL is more important.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have an HDL of like 60 or 70 or above, then your LDL numbers aren't going to matter very much.
So my my personal focus these days has been eliminating oxidative stress out of my diet and lifestyle. You know, so rigorous elimination of omega-6s.
I think the benefits of that... I'm sorry to cut you off.
Yeah, no, it's okay.
But I think the benefits of that alone is tremendous.
Mm-hmm.
The omega-6s, they oxidize inside of your body. They oxidize outside of your body before you eat them. I think half the time when you look at these epidemiological studies on, you know, vegetable oils and omega-6 fatty acids, before the person even eats them, there's a good chance that they're going to be enriched in peroxidized fats and trans fatty acids. So I think that their elimination usually is going to be net beneficial. If you want to have some sort of raw nuts or something that would have high omega-6s, but it's from a raw source that's been unprocessed, that's probably not so bad. But when it comes down to, you know, foods that are rich in vegetable oils, I think that it's better to get rid of them.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard the it's a strange theory about omega-6s being inflammation resolution?
Oh, you threw me a curveball there. I think when it comes down to inflammation resolution, the major mediators are going to be, you know, the long chain omega-3 metabolites, the resolvins and the protectins that come from the fish oil fatty acids, docosahexaenoic acid and eicosapentaenoic acid, the EPA and DHA.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to think that the inflammation resolution is going to be more attributed to that pathway. I have seen some stuff about some omega-6s, but all of this work has been done in sort of animal models and cell culture, not in humans. But what sort of makes sense to me is the either anti-inflammatory or the inflammation resolution is going to be due to the long chain omega-3s.
Okay.
I don't see very, very much need for omega-6s in the diet. Maybe a minimal amount from sort of raw, unprocessed foods. But in general, at least in all of the animal studies, you can feed an animal zero omega-6s, and as long as they're getting an adequate intake of long-chain omega-3s, then they'll experience absolutely no symptoms of deficit.
Mm-hmm. Well, just from my own calculations, I've found it's virtually impossible for me to get under a 7-to-1 ratio.
Of?
6 to 3.
Okay.
I mean, that just goes to show that, you know, creating a deficit is near impossible, right?
I mean, right, yeah. Right. I mean, the people that had the deficit were going back to that Inuit who basically all of their calories came from omega-3 rich fatty fish. So I do think it's hard to get the ratio down. Mm-hmm. But, you know, trying to eliminate the omega-6s is a good strategy.
Right. All right.
And also let me just comment one more on your point about reducing oxidative stress. And back to the testosterone and saturated fat. Saturated fat is also quite resistant to oxidative stress because of its lack of unsaturated double bonds. So I think that's another good way of sort of reducing the oxidative stress in the body.
Mm-hmm. So may readers like send you questions, or you want?
I mean, if you're on Twitter, I'm at @CaloriesProper. I try to engage as much as possible with people if they have questions. You can email me at drlagakis@gmail.com, or go right to my website and comment on the forum. I try to respond to pretty much every comment.
Awesome. Okay. Well, thank you again, and have a great evening, I guess.
Sure. Thanks, Eric. This has been great.
Okay.